If you've read a little bit of St. Augustine, you know that his whole life is a wrestling match with different kinds of challenges, intellectual, personal, friendly, and otherwise. And I'm kind of drawn to conflict, so I've been drawn to him my whole academic career. What we're going to do in my sessions is, in a sense, setting us up for thinking about Thomas Aquinas and his natural law approach, and then, of course, you know, moving into Adrian's class on jurisprudence. So Augustine is sort of here to, you know, set the table. I think, of course, he's much more than that. I choose Augustine for a reason. I guess it's partly dispositional. It's partly just, you know, my sense that there's something really, you know, fascinating going on in his different writings. I'd like to think of Thomas Aquinas as, you know, a nice interpreter of St. Augustine's, you know, and that he's best read when he's read as an interpreter of Augustine's. But we'll talk a little bit today about sort of different ways of understanding Augustine. Let me first show you, if it works, what I think of as our sort of little sketch syllabus. By the way, did the previous copies come yet?
She's working on it.
Okay, good, super. Super. I know not everybody's going to be able to read this. We're also going to get some printed copies of some texts that we're going to look at the end of class. Okay, so those will come. Maybe by tomorrow we'll have both television screens working. All right, anyway, so today I'm just setting the stage a little bit, okay, for thinking about Augustine. We're going to look at some texts on natural law at the very towards the very end of class. Generally speaking, these classes are going to be about 40 minutes or so of us, I think, talking to you guys, and then they'll be much more conversational. Although, at any point, if I say anything, please do interrupt me, stop me. I've got 6 kids. They interrupt me all the time. I'm used to finding my track of thinking eventually, or pretending that I found the track that I was on when I don't find it. So today, I'm just going to set things up a little bit. We'll look at some of those texts. Tomorrow, we're going to look at Augustine's thinking on coercion, which is kind of famous, right? Some of you will already be familiar with his writings against the Donatists, and he has this kind of real challenge and also change of mind about how to think about using coercion and politics. So we'll do that. We'll look a little bit at the problem of political complexity in St. Augustine, and we'll look in particular at his some of his texts on coercion. Complexity and complication are going to be things that I say a lot when I'm talking about St. Augustine. And again, I'm drawn to that. It's the world is not easy, right? And it's fallen. And so there's a lot that's complicated, and it's not quite a gray versus black and white type issue, but it's just, in order for us to understand things that are really kind of fine-tuned, we have to think through some complication and think hard. Then, that'll be the second class. The third class will be thinking through Rome, more or less, and looking at some texts in City of God. City of God, as you know, right, it's enormous. It was written over, you know, it took him more than a decade, around 13 years for him to write. Of course, as he's writing it, his own mind is changing and becoming, you know, occupied by other things. So it doesn't read as a kind of linear progression, even though there is that in the text. But there are points where he's kind of backtracking and picking things up there. Sometimes you're like, why did this take, you know, this turn now? In a way, it's a lot like, you know, contemporary movies when they're always like moving, you know, the time around. So you're like, you know, 3 days earlier, 2 days later, you know, net present. It's like, right, you kind of get lost a little bit. I think maybe he invented that. And then finally, the last class will just be talking about some contemporary and recent contemporary Augustinian type approaches to morality and approaches to politics. Okay, and Augustine is very, very popular for people of very different approaches to take a look at. Does that make sense? All right, sound good? Okay, so, all right, we'll leave that behind. You won't even need to look at that again until towards the end of the class and we look at some texts, okay? I'm just going to prattle on for a little bit. All right, so Augustine is, as you know, one of the major sources of our faith, really one of the major sources of the Western Christian tradition, and, you know, arguably one of the major sources of Western civilization. He and Thomas are probably the two cornerstones of the theological, philosophical tradition of the Catholic Church. But Augustine is also much more than that in a way that Thomas is not. Let's step back, though, and discuss his biography. Again, I'm sure most of you know this, but it's always good to review these kinds of things. Why is it good to review Augustine's biography before you proceed to think about what he writes? Well, he invites us to do this. He does this right in his Confessions, and he does this throughout his other texts. He's always connecting what he's thinking about to where he is in life, right? And as you know from the Confessions, I assume most of you have read it. If you've not, I invite you to read it. It's really wonderful, especially the first, purely autobiographical books of it. The later ones get more speculative and a little bit more difficult. You're like, can we talk about pears again, right? I'm kind of getting lost in all this memory stuff, but if we can go back to the pears, I was getting it, right? And the sexual issues. But he is always inviting us to pay attention to where he is in his life, explicitly telling us to do that. But also, we know as well, right, that he's the kind of thinker, he was not a systematic thinker in the way Thomas is, for whom any particular event at any particular moment was impacting the way he was thinking about things. And of course, even provoking him into actually writing about different issues. So he's getting letters constantly as a bishop, for instance, from old friends, from patrons who are interested in his work and want him to think about something, from governors, from places, nearby him, asking his advice. And imagine, right, he's trying to write the City of God, and he's also getting letters that he has to respond to. So it's, right, it's influencing the way he's thinking through and about things. And if you just think even of the sheer volume of stuff he wrote, right, it's amazing. He was like Stephen King, right, with rhetorical talent. It's a cheap shot, Stephen King. I'm sorry about that. He wrote a ton. And then, of course, you have to remind yourself he wasn't using a word processor. Right, he wasn't using an electric typewriter. He was writing right in the classic old way by hand, painstakingly, and producing literally thousands and thousands of pages of writing that we all still read. Real quick, born in 354, dies in 430 in northern Africa, and lives most of his life, spends most of his time in northern Africa, really in what is now modern Algeria. I think he becomes bishop of Hippo, right? And he's bishop for over 30 years in that city. Again, a kind of important Roman city, but in North Africa, in Muslim territory today. But at the time, of course, it was profoundly Christian, deeply Christian, split among different factions of Christianity at the time. And Augustine, of course, is deeply involved in those splits. His is also a famous story of spiritual conversion, right? A lot of people who don't have any interest in Augustine's intellectual life will focus on him as a story, of this kind of profound spiritual change of life. And he tells us, he tells us all about it. He walks us through all the different challenges that he had, right, from a kind of young, wild man who doesn't believe much in anything, to a man who begins to be really moved by issues about life and death and evil and being, to a man who eventually is drawn to Christianity, finds it initially repugnant, but then keeps going back. And in the meanwhile, as many of you know, right, of course, is his mother, sort of shadowing him, literally shadowing him at moments of his life, following him to Milan, for instance, right, and continuing to, one might say, badger him to rethink, right, his relationship with Christianity until, of course, Augustine realizes, she's been right all along and, right, has that, rather famous conversion. He more or less creates the autobiography, right? He creates a genre of writing, a kind of spiritual autobiography, which becomes, you know, a norm for the Western Christian tradition, even in the way it's told, not simply the kind of writing that it is, but even in the way it unfolds. This is something that we can attribute to St. Augustine. He's an enormous source of the Western Christian tradition, right? Just some instances, or four instances. Peter Lombard's Sentences, written in the 1150s, around 1155, of course, uses Augustine. Augustine is like primary source for that material. Gratian's Code of Canon Law, which is written around, or compiled around the same time, and lasts until 1918, which is amazing, right? It lasts some 700 years. Has Augustine, again, as a kind of principal resource for it, for, you know, Catholic, basically the law of the church. His emphasis on love, which courses throughout all of his books, not just his autobiographical books, not just his sort of mystical reflections you find in the soliloquies and elsewhere, but his constant emphasis on love becomes a kind of font for Western spiritual traditions that draw on Augustine, right? There are many of those that look to Augustine as a kind of father for them. Of course, Thomas Aquinas himself, right? If you look at Aquinas' texts, which you'll do a little bit with Father Dominic, you'll see Augustine is a major source. Scripture, Aristotle, and Augustine, right, constantly reappear in Thomas's text. I do think Thomas thinks of himself as faithfully, right, interpreting Augustine and appropriating Augustine for the age in which he was writing. But that's not all, right? The Reformation, ultimately, the Protestant Reformation looks back beyond what it perceives to be mistakes, distortions associated with scholastic thought, and, right, retraces its steps back to Augustine. So Luther, an Augustinian monk, rather famously, tries to reclaim Augustine from what he believes to be scholastic perversions. There, he argues, you find scripture best interpreted, and thus launches a Reformation project that draws on the same saint as Thomas Aquinas was drawing on. Not to be outdone, the Counter-Reformation also appeals to St. Augustine against Luther's reappropriation of Augustine and says, look, you know, you found some really great stuff, right, on man has fallen, on our dependence upon grace, but that's not the total presentation of St. Augustine. Augustine also emphasizes the capacity of human beings to respond to God's grace. Right, and through our activity, right, as free beings, to change our lives as a responsive reaction, right, as the kind of being that's capable of doing this to God's grace. So even in the Reformation itself, you have a kind of clash over the corpus of St. Augustine, again, written, you know, many, many years before this is occurring. Immanuel Kant is influenced by Augustine. His conception of radical evil finds some of its roots in Augustine's sense of the depravity of human nature. So even while, of course, we think of Enlightenment thinking, it's more or less turning its back on the patrimony of Western Christian thinking or drawing very selectively on those aspects of it that they find useful for their emphasis on the power of human rationality. Kant, much to the chagrin of many of his peers, finds, you know, this more or less true, what Augustine says about the fallenness of the human being and its capacity for evil, despite its great capacity for knowing, right? And that's, if anyone here studies Kant, I'm sure you can explain that better than I can, that's difficult stuff in Kant, but Kant nonetheless is moved by that account. Then, of course, Romanticism. The Romantic tradition also has elements that are influenced by St. Augustine's thought. Again, you know, he emphasizes feeling and love. Some people argue he really creates the Western way of speaking about the heart, about the heart knowing, about the bias, right? It's emotive reaction to certain kinds of things. Romantics draw on that conception, right? Of course, at the expense of reason, right? For them, the heart prevails over reason, and Augustine would not argue that except as, right, a kind of contingent phenomenon of, right, our fallenness. That, but nonetheless, that, right, our heart can have access to things that reason would then, you know, be able to confirm or corroborate when it's thinking well. He's a thorn in the side of Nietzsche, right? Nietzsche, right, is concerned about St. Augustine's influence on the West. He influences Foucault. Foucault reads Augustine. In the United States, there are many later Augustinian thinkers. We'll talk a little bit about one on Friday. Reinhold Niebuhr, the great Protestant political realist, thinks of himself as Augustinian, emphasizing obviously the more Protestant strand of St. Augustine. Barack Obama mentions that he has, you know, read with great edification at least some of St. Augustine's corpus. So he continues to be read today. He continues and has always been read by a very wide-ranging set of thinkers, thinkers whose thought is more or less contradictory to each other, claim Augustine as their father, right? Their great influence, which suggests difficulty in his text, right? If lots of people are reading and they're coming to very different conclusions about things, it suggests, you either changed at different points, right? And they're referring to the younger or the older versions of St. Augustine. It could suggest as well incoherence, right? That, you know, you were yourself not settled on things. I think it rightly suggests both of those. I think you can, say, at times Augustine appears to change his mind. Of course, rather famously, he identifies the times he thinks he's changed his mind later in his life and writes Retractions, where he goes back and looks at different things that he's written, and he says, I thought this before, and I'm not so keen on that any longer, or I didn't think this, but I became convinced by somebody else. Now, I've come around to this position. Others would argue there are other places as well where he seems to have changed his mind that he didn't identify, or within particular books, right? He kind of goes like this every once in a while. Like I said, City of God is written over a 13-year period. I wrote a book. Took me about 2.5 years, and there must be things in there, I'm sure, right, where I say X, and, by the end of the book, I probably say something close to not X. So I think, there is some of that. And then, of course, most importantly, he's responding to different things, right? Different points in his life, he's responding to different pastoral concerns, pastoral and political concerns in the community in which he lives, right? In the early Christian communities, there are violent, bloody arguments over all matter of doctrinal issues. And people look to this brilliant young man to address them. And sometimes when he's responding to certain kinds of Pelagian points, he comes out heavy anti-Pelagian, right? This, of course, really attracts Luther. Right, those texts would be things that Luther would be particularly interested in, right? And then there are other times when he's dealing with heavy anti-Pelagian type issues, and he comes out a little bit more talking about the human capacity for virtue, the human capacity to grow in morality, and those will be things that will draw other people. They're not necessarily in conflict, but they're, right, the emphatic points made differently at different moments in his career, okay? We can only get the slightest taste of that, unfortunately, in 4 short classes in a week. If you haven't already started looking at Augustine, and I know your vocations don't always allow this, I do suggest that you do. He really merits reading and rereading. He's just a wonderful, wonderful thinker. All right, so let's sort of walk again a little bit through, or more closely through, the intellectual biography. Through St. Augustine, we know Cicero better than we would otherwise, right? The great Roman philosophical thinker. Many of his texts are lost, and one of the most important texts for Augustine's autobiography is the Hortensius, right? If you read the Confessions, you learn that this becomes a kind of pivotal text in Augustine's life. He's already looking to try to solve certain kinds of questions that are bothering him, and the Hortensius is recommended to him by an old mentor, more or less, and he picks it up and he finds in this great text of Cicero's, where Cicero is responding to certain kinds of arguments about the use of leisure time, and he advocates philosophical study. This is something that Augustine can sink his teeth into. Augustine's about 17 at this point, right? Don't know what you guys are doing at 17, but Augustine around 17 or so, right? My life has changed by reading Cicero's Hortensius. We don't have that text, right? We don't have the full text of the Hortensius. We have bits and pieces of it from Augustine and other classical writers. I think it's lost around the 6th century or so. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll find it. But we have large chunks. Augustine quotes large chunks of that text for us. That and some other accounts are where we get some sense of what Cicero is doing in that. But through reading this, he turns to Scripture. He's provoked into thinking that, okay, now I should read Scripture as a consequence of reading this. Again, he's very, very young, but he's extraordinarily intellectually gifted. He's a rhetorician. He's been studying rhetoric. He's probably a little pretentious as a young man. You know, he's got some knowledge. He turns, however, to a recent translation of Scripture into Latin that is not particularly good. And Augustine finds it vulgar. He finds it kind of, base, unsophisticated. It's not a translation that sets him on fire. It's not words, language, rhetoric that moves him. He tries it out and finds it wanting, and of course moves on. That Christian thing is not for him. As you know, the next step in his trip is Manichaeism. He turns instead to a group of thinkers who seem in some respects to be Christian, in some respects to be, kind of old, influenced by older religious traditions, who have some good answers, who answer some of his questions or have some partial responses to questions that he finds provoking. He is drawn to the way it explains the cosmos, this kind of conflict between darkness and lightness, spirit and matter. It does account for certain, or it does provide a kind of beginning account for certain problems that young people have, right? Why is the world screwed up? Why do good people seem to be rained on and bad people seem to get ahead? I won't say anything about politics, right? Right, that kind of conflictual model of two forces competing through eternity begins to make some sense of these kinds of issues. And of course, it provides some account, a beginning account of the problem of evil. Why is there evil in the first place? And the Manichaeans, right, try to sort of describe a conception of the cause of evil. They do this in part by adopting some of the kind of selective texts from the New Testament and eschewing the Old Testament. The Old Testament, right, is the testament of the evil God, right, the God of pain and suffering and wrath. The New Testament is the God of light, or kind of expression of the God of light. So we can eschew the Old Testament in favor of the New Testament. Augustine is moved by this, and he is with them for more than a decade, right? This influences his life powerfully. It's not a fleeting notion of his. In fact, he is sent by them to Milan. He's this young, upstart rhetorician. He's intellectually powerful. They look at him as somebody who could be a star eventually. He's still only a hearer. He's not, he's not one of the elect. He's not in the inner circle of the Manichaean movement, but he's powerful. So he's sent by them to Milan in around 384. And there, of course, his life changes through his encounter with St. Ambrose, the bishop of Milan. Ambrose is, I think, just about the first intellectual powerhouse Christian that Augustine runs into, right? And because Ambrose, who by this point in his life, right, is older, he's been a provincial governor in northern Italy, you know, around Milan, right? Great life experience. He's a first-rate mind. He's been educated very well. He's fluent in Greek. He knows the literary tradition that Augustine knows. Augustine probably doesn't even know it quite as well as Ambrose does. These are all things that impress Augustine. Wow, a Christian can be smart, right? A Christian can be an intellect. A Christian can be well-educated. These are things this guy from North Africa does not take for granted, right? Augustine doesn't grow up around books the way people in Rome will grow up around books. So this becomes enormously, again, autobiographically important that Augustine runs into someone like this. Through Ambrose and Simplicianus, another peer or older friend of Augustine's at this time, he becomes familiar with the Neoplatonic texts and the Neoplatonic tradition. Right? It's at this point that Augustine begins to see, through discussions with Ambrose and Simplicianus, again, he tells us these things, right? So this is how, at least partly, we know them. He begins to have deep difficulties with some small problems he already had with the Manichaean explanation of different issues. And these problems deepen by studying the new Platonists, right? That's all these guys are, right? They're the new wave of Platonists, people who are reading Plato's texts and finding in them solutions that Augustine ultimately thinks are, the ones, more or less, right? These are really powerful solutions, particularly the dialectical approach of the Platonic dialogues. That, of course, becomes very influential on Augustine, and many of his first writings are attempts to recreate Platonic dialogues, including on the freedom of the will, which we'll look at eventually. Also, the Platonic discussion of identity and difference, ways of resolving the fact of the phenomenon of identity, the philosophical problems of identity, and also difference. What does it mean when we say X and Y are different? It suggests already a kind of identity between them. Otherwise, saying they're different isn't all that interesting, right? That they are somehow similar, right, or have properties that are, that we can identify as not quite identical, right, leads us to think about their differences. The same when you say, well, they're different, right, implies a certain kind of unity, right? And Augustine is drawn to these kinds of explanations, finding them quite superior to the Manichaean explanations of things. Of course, there's a kind of famous scene in Augustine's biography where, as he's beginning to turn already on Manichaean thought, he's convinced that, look, we know you got these problems, but wait till Faustus comes, right? Wait till Faustus comes. When Faustus comes, he's going to answer your questions, right? Faustus the Manichaean. Right, maybe he's like Jordan Peterson or something, right? You wait till you listen to this guy, Augustine. You've got problems with the Odyssey, whatever, Faustus can handle them. You've got problems with the way we think about eternity. Faustus is all over that, right? He's got YouTube videos like crazy. So Faustus comes through, Augustine goes to meet him. He wants to hear this, and I think some of you will have read, he's extraordinarily disappointed. Right? Not that this guy's not on, he's clearly intelligent, right? But the depth of thinking, the kind of lack of sophistication philosophically, don't impress Augustine, and this becomes, more or less the breaking point for him. I was told, this is the guy who's going to answer these questions, Faustus, can't quite do it in the way, again, the Neoplatonic tradition can. So Augustine moves on from the Manichaeans at that point, and really begins his turn towards Christianity, goes back to looking at the scriptures again, right, finds in them real consonances, points of convergence with the Neoplatonic tradition, and, you know, more or less moves on from there. Okay? Now, let's pivot real quick. That's just some, you know, some background, okay? We're going to talk now about natural law in Augustine. Now, one of the interesting things about Augustine is he's often not thought of as a natural law thinker. Both within Catholicism and, of course, outside of Catholicism, one of the real draws of St. Augustine is he, some people argue, he's more or less a repudiation to the neat natural law theory of scholastic Catholicism. And perhaps Father Dominic will speak a little bit about this as well. But there are certain kinds of caricatures that operate here, right? That by virtue of the natural law and natural law thinking, Catholics think, and the Catholic philosophical tradition, theological tradition, think that they can square every circle, right? They can account for everything neatly, a priori, right? You can explain what will happen, what should happen, why it should happen, and so on, right? And that the world operates in a way that allows us to do this despite its fallenness, right? Despite its fallenness. So you get a kind of soft fall theory, right? And just made that up right now. Right? You get a kind of soft fall theory in the Catholic tradition that allows the power of reason to, right, understand and prescribe for us behavior that we can then follow. And the argument goes, the caricature goes, Augustine, right, does not fit that. Both because he has a hardball theory, right? Hard and soft power operating in my mind here at this point, right? So he has a hardball theory. And that hardball theory doesn't allow for that kind of neat squaring of circles, right? Both because reason is so affected by it, we can't possibly know in the way that the caricatured softball theory lets us think we could know. And also because our will is so disordered by the hardball, right? That even if we knew it, right? Even if we knew it well, we couldn't live it, right? All you would experience is what often we experience. I know I shouldn't eat this piece of chocolate cake, right? I'm trying to get fit, trying to run a marathon, but it's good, right? And it's chocolatey, it's creamy, it's, you know, sweet. It's all those things that chocolate cake is. Father Dominic is not, you know, interested in these kinds of things, but we can't resist it, right? We can't resist it. We know all the time what we should do, but our lives are experiences of being incapable of doing them, right? Okay, that's what we experience. That's what the hardball theory approach, often associated with certain types of Protestantism, right, will advance. This is what the moral life looks like, right? And we're not saved by a grace that empowers us to do good things. Right, and to see, right, and to see and to know what we should do, and to figure out, look, this looks like a dilemma, but I've identified by operating in this way, right, I can kind of squeeze through what appears like a dilemma and find the good act to do, right? No, instead, they argue, sometimes there are real moral dilemmas in this screwed up world, right? The world is so fallen that sometimes the only choice is, which of these bad things, right, is the least bad thing for you to do? And then I'll do the least bad thing and be saved nonetheless, right? Because that's how God's grace operates, right? I'm saved despite myself. I'm saved despite the things that I do. Okay? Power, right? That's a powerful account. It fits, right? It does fit some of our experience. It does even fit some of what we know about the different ways people have been saved in our tradition, right, and perhaps in your own lives, right? This is not, right, a weak theory, but I don't actually think it's Augustine's. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. Of course, the non-students got it right.
Well, no, just as you're speaking, I wonder, have people hypothesized that one of the explanations between those hard fall and soft fall approaches could be the very moral life of the person who sees it that way, so that if Thomas is living a virtuous life in the echo chamber of his home, in the office, and his passions are ordered to reason, then he can see it this way, and grace looks like this, and nature isn't that bad. But if you're Luther or Kant, and you there is no way that the passions could be conformed to the reason, then you see it in this heartfelt. There is, maybe that's an obvious thing, I don't know.
So would this be, so if I did see it that way, well, let's say we do see it that way, does that vindicate the, I'm sorry, this is inadequate, the softball theory? Or does it vindicate the hardball theory, or is it trying to posit a kind of median way between them? I guess my way of answering would be, I think for those who view it in the hardball way, right, what they would say about the person whose life appears to be ordered in that way is good, great. But there's no reason for us to expect that tomorrow it doesn't collapse. In the next few minutes it doesn't collapse. Right? Because their understanding of the way the will has been damaged, right, by sin, by the fall, doesn't allow, or would not allow for, as for instance, right, the kind, and this is not the only way to account for this, kind of virtuous, the kind of arguably unity of virtue, right, that might be presumed to be operating in that person at that point. So what I think you might say is like, pardon the popular references, but it's kind of like a Ned Flanders situation, right? Like, everything seems kind of well ordered, right? But you sense that it's brittle as can be, right? And if things go wrong, they're going to go wrong, spectacularly, and you're going to want to be there, right? I think that's it, but I wonder, which way your question's driving.
It may just be an Aristotelian perspective, where he would say that there are very few who actually live this virtuous life, and those are the ones who might be allowed to see the soft fall theory. And everybody else, the rest of us, who do struggle, maybe are more inclined to see the hard fall.
Right. Who's the guy who studies with John Lear? Right. Lear writes on this a little bit, right? And, it would be among those that would say Aristotle, even himself, right, is not quite clear about whether we can ever actually this in a kind of permanent way. It's momentary, and there's no predictive value of it. And Aristotle kind of appears to question the whole thing by the end of the Ethics himself. But that's Lear, right? There's one interpretation of Aristotle. You want to say
one? Well, really, maybe. One way of putting this issue is that people sympathetic to Hegel will often say that Christianity is not a tragic religion. There's no real space for tragedy.
Right.
Because there's always a right thing to do.
Right.
There's never an irreconcilable conflict between two goods.
Right.
Right. And we do have that canon, that tragedy, which says that there is.
That would be the softball.
Right.
But
one way, at least, I guess it depends on how the interpreter is said, but Trent does say that there is no situation where the baptized has to sin.
That's right.
Which does,
right,
in a sense, deflate tragedy.
It does, that's right. And whereas it's reacting to the not possible not to sin account of certain Reformation thinkers, right? Non peccari, right? It's not possible not to sin because the world is so screwed up. And Trent says, no, that's false, right? And that's why I gave a quick account of facing a dilemma, right? The dilemma appears like sin or not, right? And the Catholic, right, he tries to navigate, well, those are not the choices. I'm not seeing this properly, right? If I step back and relook at it, right, or if I, sort of get myself right, I can identify that there's something here that can be done that's good. This is like the just war account, right, in a way, right? Where, for instance, you know, we argue, I think, that this is not a lesser evil, right? The killing of Ward is not, okay, I'm going to choose the least evil thing to do, right? That sometimes, right, it's required, and to do it is good, right? It's not actually bad. It's, my soul is not corrupted by this activity. Now, if, right, through action of theory, right, this killing is the appropriate killing at this point. Whereas, you know, the sort of classic realist account of this, which often will trace itself to the harder theory of Augustine, will say, nah, that's wrong, right? That's just you Catholics trying to live sinless lives, right? This is screwed up. It's a consequence of the world being screwed up. And I'm just going to choose the lesser evil here. I'm going to sin and sin boldly, right? That's the Protestant Lutheran account. Sin and sin boldly. Because you're saved nonetheless. God saved Paul, right? God saves us sinners in the midst of our sin.
I was just going to say, there's also then the layer of understanding freedom, because you can hold that you can't avoid evil, and also that you never have to sin if you take freedom into account, because the foundation of all morality is your understanding of freedom. Because if there is no freedom, then there's no deliberation of right and wrong.
Sure.
There's simply no freedom.
Sure.
So if you take freedom into consideration, you say, well, we're not, because of our fallen state, it's unavoidable that we'll do evil, but if we didn't choose that evil, just kind of occurred, we can't help but X, Y, or Z kind of occur, where, you know, my father says something to me, I talk back to him.
Right.
Kind of, well, I didn't deliberate about doing that. That just kind of happened. It's more of an error than a sin. So you could hold that the Catholic, the Christian never has to sin. No one ever has to sin, and that be true, but at the same time also hold it. You can't avoid, not that I hold that, but I'm saying it does hold together if you take into consideration kind of the amount of freedom that's in choosing or not certain actions.
For sure, right, for sure. And what we're beginning to see here, and this is why this is fun, right, is these are rival accounts, right? These are different accounts of within the Christian fold of the way the world is, right? And they're both powerful accounts, right? I think we all are on the side of one of those accounts more so than the other. But these, right, they're really powerful accounts, and they entail all different kinds of things. Ultimately, the relationship of nature and grace, right? Ultimately, and we were talking about this earlier, but this, somebody, I can't remember who it was, but this is ultimately about the relationship of nature to grace, and to what extent nature has become so debased by sin that it's, right, it's really more or less cut off from grace, except by some sort of divine activity. Let's go, though. Like I said, I don't think that's that kind of caricature where Augustine is anti-nature, anti-natural law is right. Is fair to Augustine. I know the texts we can go to and find them that will support the hardball Augustine. But there are other texts that are often, you know, overlooked in making that account. And I've just given you just a sampling of these things. Augustine does not use the language of natural law very often. Okay, that's one thing. And there's also an issue about Augustine's relationship with Aristotle. Right, which initially people would have said when I was a young man, right, Augustine never read Aristotle, did not know Aristotle. But there's actually more and more scholarship that's suggesting, in fact, he did know at least some Aristotle or secondhand Aristotelian thinking, right? We always just think of him as Platonic, Neoplatonic, and so on. So there's a kind of rethinking of Augustine and Aristotle, which would be fascinating, right, in some ways. But let's look at this first text from De Trinitate. Augustine's also a beautiful writer, of course, right? And that's something that gets overlooked. And I mean, I can't speak to Thomas Aquinas, but I'll say it anyway. I don't know that Aquinas is quite a beautiful writer. Augustine is. Okay, there it is. I said it. But right, there's real beauty and turn of phrase in Augustine.
I guess the beauty's in the system or something, right? anyone want to read this one for us? Thank you very much.
For hence it is that even the ungodly think of eternity, and rightly blame and rightly praise many things in the morals of men. And by what rules do they thus judge, except by those wherein they see how men ought to live, even though they themselves do not so live? And where do they see these rules? For they do not see them in their own moral nature, since no doubt these things are to be seen by the mind, and their minds are confessedly changeable. But these rules are seen as unchangeable by him who can see them at all. Nor yet in the character of their own mind, since these rules are rules of righteousness, and their minds are confessedly unrighteous. Where indeed are these rules written, wherein even the unrighteous recognizes what is righteous, wherein he discerns that he ought to have what he himself has not? Where then are they written, unless in the book of that light which is called truth, whence every righteous law is copied and transferred, not by migrating to it, but by being impressed impressed upon it, to the heart of the man that works righteousness, as the impression from a ring passes into the wax, yet does not leave the ring.
Isn't it beautiful? Right? Okay, so this is natural law he's talking about here, right? It's not identified as such. It's in the passage on the Trinity, which is not a text. It's not, again, like it would be in Thomas or the scholastic tradition. Now we're writing about or thinking about the natural law, right? Here it is. It comes up. It's not identified in that way. But this is clearly about natural law. What is the problem of this little passage? I'm not saying like what you find problematic about the passage. What is the problem he's describing to us in that little passage? Yeah.
Having more knowledge not being able to justify it.
Right. So you we have this knowledge, right? We know it, even though we can't. We know we also can't do it, right? Or don't do it. We know we're not righteous, right? I know I'm a guy who will eat the cake, right, or watch the extra, movie at 2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, right, when I should be sleeping, right? We know our weakness, but nonetheless, we know there's some law, and we know, what else do we know about the law? What do we know about the law? It's unchanging, right? We know the law, it has that character of unchangeability that we, in our mind, don't even have, right? So where could this come from? Where could this come? I mean, I find this beautiful, right? I mean, the way this problem is set up, right? It's, you're a hypocrite, right? You say that what this, the law is, and yet you can't do it. Well, all right, he's dealing with that here to some extent, right? But even the person accusing the person of being a hypocrite is not saying this law doesn't bind, right? We're all acknowledging in some way the law. Where could that law be from? Where is it from? Masking. Yeah,
he says the light which is called truth.
Okay.
So
God. Yes. Right. It's from the eternal. Right? It's from the eternal. It's unchanging itself. It's from the eternal. It's from the ring that makes the impression upon us that does not, however, give us, right? Right, the impression. The impression is made on us. Okay? It's on us, in us, it's of our nature. Okay, but it's not as though God, right, injects it right into us. God is now in us in the same way, right? It's that beautiful, it's not left the ring, but by our nature, right, it's impressed upon us. Okay? So that's a kind of classic natural law text. I don't know that Luther cared about it. Okay, so here's more like on the eternal law. Anybody else want to read? Good way to get extra credit. Yeah. So it's the undergrads, right?
Yeah. Whatever sets man above the beast, where we call it mind, whether we call it mind or spirit, or more correctly, both, since we find both terms in scriptures. If this rules over and commands the other parts that make up men, then man's life is in perfect order. We are to think of a man well-ordered, therefore, when his reason rules over these movements of the soul. For we must not speak of right order or of order at all, when the more perfect is made subject to the less perfect. But it follows, therefore, that when reason, or mind, or spirit rules over the irrational movements of the soul, then that is in control. Then that is in control in man, which ought to be by virtue of the law, which we found to be eternal.
Okay. Very Platonic, right, or Neoplatonic at this point, about the right ordering of things. You guys are, I'm sure, most of you familiar with this already. This is very Augustinian. Okay, get everything right. Everything has to be ordered properly. Mind or spirit, or he, of course, prefers to use both of them, are in command of other parts of the human being. In those cases that the human being is well ordered, by virtue of the law that is eternal, right? And it's another reference to the way our ordering of ourselves, which is another way of speaking about natural law, right? Our ordering of ourselves draws on the eternal law. Okay? Any questions about that passage? It's good stuff, right? That's from on the freedom of the will. And here's, I think these are the last two passages. One from a commentary on the Psalm, 118, and the other from a letter that he writes, number 157. Who wants to read both of those? One after the other. Thank you.
No one injures another without at the same time hoping the same will not be done to himself. And in this respect, he transgresses the law of nature. The very fact that he does not want to suffer the fate he inflicts on someone else means that he cannot plead ignorance of the natural law. Was this natural law not present in the people of Israel? Certainly it was, for they too were human. They could no more have been without the natural law than they could have been alien to the human condition itself. Hence, since there is also a law in the reason of a human being who already uses free choice, a law naturally written in his heart, by which he is warned that he should not do anything to anyone else that he himself does not want to suffer, all are transgressors according to this law, even those who have not received the law given through Moses.
All right. Pretty straightforward. Correct? Classic natural law type responses to what's the problem that he's responding to in these two texts? Problems? Pretty straightforward. No trick question.
The application of the Old Testament.
That would be in a sense like what to make of men and women in the Old Testament, right? But I put universality, right? The problem of, hey, are we all bound by this morality? Augustine's response is, yeah, right? Yeah, we are all bound by the same morality, natural law. It bound even the men and women of Israel, right? Why? How do we know this? How do we know this? How did they know it? How did they know they were bound by it? Really easy answer. Yeah.
Well, like human beings, so they're endowed by reason.
How do they know? Like how when I do something bad, do I know? Like if I take your wallet, right? How do I know I shouldn't be taking your wallet, according to this passage?
Because you would know that you wouldn't want to
taking your wallet, so I have, whatever you've got, your wallet, I don't know if you've got your wallet, right, I was going to say more money, but you're a student, so who knows, right, right, it's a really nice leather wallet, right, so, right, look, I don't want you taking my wallet. I know there's a rule that says don't take something that's not your own, right, I know that. They knew that. They didn't want people doing the things that they complained people were doing to them, right? And they didn't want people doing things that they might do to other people. And we all know this. This is some suggestion that we have a sense of what morality requires of us. How? Well, we know we don't want people doing stuff to us that we might even do to them, right? Yeah.
So this might be too far of a tangent. If it is, just cut me off. But if I remember correctly, and I know this of Aquinas, I'm pretty sure I remember, if I remember correctly, Augustine's commentary on Romans 2, he identifies the Romans 2:14 as referring to a believing Gentile, and Aquinas does the same thing. They both use either the citation or language from the passage to defend this kind of universality of natural law. I'm wondering how they square that. If the passage is referring to believing Gentiles, not Gentiles across the board, how do they square that with the argument for universality?
Why would it be difficult to square that argument? Because, I mean, why does the fact that I believe...
Well,
believe in Christ...
Yeah, so if the natural law is in my heart because I am a believing Gentile, why does it then necessarily...
It's not in my heart because I'm a believing Gentile.
Okay.
It's in my heart already, whether I'm a believing Gentile or not.
So what then do they mean by identifying that passage as written on the heart passage as referring to believing Gentiles? Because it seems, at least on when I've read them, it seems like what they're saying in the commentary is there is that... This path, the written, it's written on our heart because we're believers, but then they take it and use it.
It's right. Whereas it clearly says here, it's right. It's written on the people of Israel's heart.
Yeah.
Right. Look, I can't speak at all to what Thomas says about this, but I don't think Augustine's explanation there is that the sort of logical justification for why this person has the law inscribed in his heart is because he's a believing Gentile, as opposed to simply trying to sort of more literally, faithfully understand who's the object of this reflection. We'd have to look at it together and see if you really think he's saying something different than that. Father Dominic, do you know off the top of your head that passage? Did you hear that?
Don't worry about it.
If you want to, you can ask him later. Because clearly, what we see here in the other passages does not require that you be believing in order for the law to be, right? What does it require? What does it require that it's on your heart? Well, not that you're believing, but that you're
human.
Thank you, right? That you're a human being. Right, that you're this kind of being, the being that has freedom, right? The being that is made in God's image. And that, of course, does not require belief. That's simply right by virtue of creation. So this is true of anybody. And again, we can know this. It's also a claim about how we can know, how we're accountable to it, even though we are not believers. Okay? They were human. They cannot plead ignorance of the natural law, even though they were obviously not believers in Christ. Right? Which is something that some aspects of the Protestant tradition will deny. Right? They'll say, no, you can't know it unless you believe, or they say you can't do it unless you believe, or they say it doesn't matter. Right? Unless you believe, they say different kinds of things. But that's not what he says here. Yeah.
So would it be right to evaluate kind of what Father Pinkares does with Augustine on freedom? Is Augustine's concept of the natural law is rooted in our desire for happiness? In that you know, this whole thing of the golden rule is based on, well, I know this, there's this thing called happiness which I want, and that goes against it in my own life, therefore I shouldn't do it to that other person because it would take that away in their own pursuit. Maybe on a base level, but still, it seems to be, but maybe I'm wrong, I'm just saying,
this is
his main argument for the natural law, that it's also rooted in his argument, or what Pinkeris extracts from him with regards to his concept of freedom, is that it's all rooted in what our pursuit of happiness is, that we know that we're made for something.
Good question. Anthony, you want to respond?
Yeah. I mean, it has to be. I mean, insofar as you're going to call happiness the last end, just because any virtue, insofar as it makes its subject good, is a way in which it's disposing its subject to its last end, right? So if you're talking about the law, which is something that the subject is conforming to fulfill its last end, then, when you were talking about the wallet thing, I was kind of raising that around it because it seems that you have to, in order to have real knowledge of natural law, it seems you can have a moral sense without knowledge of the last end. In order to actually have knowledge of the natural law, it seems you would have to have a relatively thorough idea of the last end, because you can't even be made good in any respect if you're not disposed to pursue the last end better by being that way, which would require you to have knowledge of the last end. But so that is obviously necessarily the type of happiness, right? Because you can't be made good at all unless you're moving towards that, because as a rational animal, you have to have that in your intellect before everything else. It's something you're just going to move there by any configuration that isn't your own, or not from an external.
Yeah. So, but you're asking a question to me, right? With the are you okay with his response to you?
Yeah, I don't see anything contrary to what I said.
Right. I think he's just right. It's been a long time since I've read Pinkeris, to be honest with you, so I don't want to speak to that. Right. You keep saying made good, right? You can't be made good unless you know. Right, unless you have knowledge of the last end and so on, right? Which would seem to have posed a certain kind of problem to people of Israel. They could know something of the last end, arguably, right? Maybe we could even argue that they could know the last, right? But it's not revealed to them in its fullness, for sure, right? Is that true?
I mean,
Christ has not come.
Right, but yeah. They're still trying to conform themselves to God. So even if they don't have it.
Yeah, they are.
Right.
Arguably. Yeah, they are. Right. But it would seem like the incarnation matters. Right? It reveals man to himself and so on, all that stuff, right?
Right, I'm
on.
Yeah.
You are. I'm just saying that
actually the general.
I'm saying that I think this is a good question, and it's a question that vexes all of this, right? Obviously, right? What can we know and what can we do or become? Right? You said we cannot be made good unless, not just know.
Well, yeah, because I mean, you have to know. I mean,
can I know the natural law without being made good, or without being able to be made good?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is he saying here? Is he saying they can know the natural law, but not necessarily, right? He's not talking about whether they can follow it in its fullness and so on.
Right, but I mean, when I say you can't know, I'm saying that it's almost, you don't have, if it's just the moral sensibility, then it's not knowledge. If you just kind of have an instinct that this is good, then that has to be supplemented for the actual reason that it's good. Otherwise, you might be forming good habits, but those good habits don't actually, they're not connected to a last end if that last end is not in your life.
Right, and this gets into what Augustine thinks about virtues and so on, right? And the capacity for people who don't know God to have actual virtues, right? The Romans and their possession of virtues and so on, correct? Yeah. All I would say, just to defend the wallet thing, is I think it's all about the wallet, right? I would think he's not saying it's mere moral intuition. I think he's saying they can have knowledge of moral law, right? They know what the law is, whether they can follow it, right? And whether, in a sense, right, they have it in its fullness. Those are subsequent questions, clearly, right? You want to respond to
that? The last thing I would say is that it seems like it is a fundamentally different kind of knowledge, though, or different knowledge of something completely different, just because Like, if you don't, you're trying to conform yourself to the law itself without the proper context of the common good of why you're doing it in the first place. Like, you're not really conforming yourself to the law if you don't have the broader context. I mean, doesn't.
Yeah, good stuff. Is that a hand, Father
Doctor? Yeah, I'm sorry. You then.
It just seems like you can speak of someone being good, simply speaking, or being good, being quick, in some respect. And so, if the virtues are not ultimately formed by charity for Augustine, then they're not truly, you're not simply good. But you could, I think it, you could say that it is good for someone not to be a thief, right? So there's a goodness there. There's a certain virtue of justice. Maybe it's not properly formed in the end. And also, I think a lot of, you can actually act in accordance with the common good without knowing it. I mean, thank God for that, because otherwise only philosophers would be good, you know? So there's a way in which the conformity of the will, well, of course, knowledge does precede willing. That knowledge doesn't have to be, perfect, but to see how my action is ultimately ordered to God or to the
right. But this is not necessarily about being good. This is also about, another way to put this is about their condemnation by the law, whether they are justly condemned by the law, right? And of course, if you're going to say there's no natural law, they have no knowledge of it, then they cannot be condemned, right? But they appear to be condemned by the law for their transgressions, for their, right, they're not obeying God, and so on. And Augustine say, well, of course, they're accountable. They know the law, to some extent at least, right? Luke is next, okay? And then maybe one more question, then I have to leave the stage. Yeah, Luke.
Well, I mean, on this whole exchange, you crush flagging something I think you're trying to do.
Yeah.
By framing it this way, is that we're already jumping and reporting a great deal of Aristotelian action theory
right,
and language
right.
by talking about intellect and knowledge of the end.
That's right.
All of which isn't quite Augustinian language. I mean, he will say similar things about Agnes, perhaps. But the picture of the universe is a little different. Even the language version is different. So if we're trying to get into Augustine, it's important not to jump. And poor Thomas, I think.
Just on the virtue point. Because, I mean, regardless of any framework you're using a virtue, I mean, for Augustine especially, I almost think, like, at least in Aquinas' citation of him in question 58, when he's on the virtues, when he says, I forget where the Augustine's definition of virtue is, but it's when he says that a virtue is something that God brings about within you, without you, like it's precisely because it has to be tied to the last day, because it has to be related to charity, that's the case for Augustine with regard to virtue. So, of course, and so just the last thing, I mean, just that's why virtue, I think, has to be necessarily tied to making you love God more.
But again, he's not talking about virtue.
Agreed.
Clearly, right? And he never does it systematically the way Thomas does, and we all know, right? It's all occasional. So, part of what he's doing is railing against the Romans for certain, right, misapprehensions of things. And then he's exalting them, right? And their apparent virtues by comparison to the other peoples around them and so on. So, I mean, these are all good points. Like I said, the problem here is I haven't read him here in a long time, so I don't know what I would say. Well, look, my initial response was Luke's, in the sense, or what Luke saw, perhaps, in the way I expressed it was, I don't know if Augustine would quite put it that way. You can construct that in Augustine, but I don't know that Augustine would quite put it that way. About it being about happiness, rooted in the desire for happiness. Okay. Two more people, okay? So you get to go.
Just very quickly. I was just going to say, yeah.
And then Joseph, okay? So I'm not leaving anybody out, am I? Okay. Desmond and Joseph. Yeah.
What I get from this is a bit of, you could just use Plato's analogy of a cave, where you can understand, I see the shadow, I know that there's a thing. Things produce a shadow, I can see the outline of the shadow. So even if you do not have the full knowledge of what the ultimate end is, you can still recognize and therefore be condemned by denying the reality of the fact that there is a a natural law. There is a universal desire for all of us to be happy, and therefore if you work against that towards other people, you're kind of denying the fact that that exists whilst, you know, you have knowledge of the shadow and the outline, but you don't have perfect knowledge. And, you know, I think the most famous line from Augustine is, we're restless until we rest in you. Not everyone knows the you, but they recognize
they know the
restlessness and that there is a you out there. They just don't know him.
Yes, I can't let it go, sorry. But there's nothing in there to suggest he thinks, right, that they don't know it, right? And here, at least, he's saying they know it. It's not even a shadow. They know it. They know the law. They're accountable to the law. And their failure, therefore, is a moral failure, at least at this point, right? And again, he'll say things later that, of course, Thomas will pick up on, that will incline us, you know, to perhaps a more Thomistic reading of these kinds of things. Yeah.
So when I was reading this, I was thinking, would Augustine say the same thing about the Babylonians or the Egyptians or the Canaanites? You know, the statement, was this natural law not present in the people of Babylon,
right,
for instance? Or does the full knowledge of the natural law require that being in the good graces of God, so to speak, either, you know, one of the Old Testament covenants or through baptism? I guess I'm also thinking, as I think through this question, I have in the back of my mind a sort of secular liberal critique of natural law, which is, oh, well, look at all these pagan civilizations,
right,
and people seem to be doing all sorts of different things. And I mean, is Christianity required, right, to understand the fullness of
right
natural law?
Yes, those are all good questions. and I'll dodge every one of them now. Yeah, those are great questions, but they're recurring questions in the tradition. When I was a student at Notre Dame under the dissenting theologian Richard McCormick, mm-hmm. Jesuit, we had a class on the specificity of Christian ethics. It was a thing in the, you know, the early 70s and so on, right, about, are we really believing anything differently than everybody else's? And does it actually affect our, you know, our morality? And you know, what they concluded, you know, more or less, was it kind of affects the way you do it, right? You know, you do it with a, you know, Christian cheer or something like that. But otherwise, morality is basically the exact same thing. This issue, and you can see, in fairness to everybody who's spoken, right, this is the problem we're talking about is what I described, right, that there's a kind of, right, there are more Thomistic moments of Augustine. I think Luke put this really well. We sometimes read Thomas right straight back into him, when there are other aspects of Augustine that, you know, are going to be picked up upon by other people. There's, some of you guys might know this, a kind of interesting trend among some political theologians for a defense of liberal political ordering, and I mean like liberal political ordering, in Augustine, right? You can find in Augustine, right, an account that allows us to defend a very low-flying, process-oriented, rights-oriented political liberal theology against, you know, any sort of common good-oriented virtue, let's make people better oriented thing, which, you know, arguably is what Aquinas is about. So, right, people draw on, right, this is going to happen, right, this is not a surprise, but this is what makes it fun. All right?
Let's thank our speaker.